critical means in architectural terms to make some form of commentary on what exists. Now you could argue that everything, anytime one does something, is to make a commentary on what exists. In other words, if you're in a suburban neighborhood and they're all little pitched roof houses, suburban houses, you could argue that to make one like it would be to make a commentary that you agree with that kind of house. That's not the kind of critical commentary that I mean. What I mean by criticality is to look, to make something, to look at something, to think about something that changes in some way the status quo, either transforms it, denies it, adds to it in some way, but is not neutral, that is, about the status quo. So therefore, if you did a house like all other houses in a block, you could argue that that would be neutral to do what everybody else is doing. The idea of criticality is anti what I call, or what is called, the zeitgeist, that is, the spirit of the age. And a lot of people believe that one does architecture because of the way things are at a particular moment in time. Now, for example, this building was done at a particular moment in time when it transformed what the existing geist or spirit was at that moment in time. If you were to do a building like this today, people would sort of think, well, it's old-fashioned, old hat, reactionary. You wouldn't do a building like this today. So that one has to be conscious of the moment in time always that one is operating in. And therefore, that commentary is always placed within a context. In other words, if you were to, we're going to look at some paintings today that were critical at the time they were painted. If you were to paint them today, they would no longer be critical. Why? Because the commentary that they were making at the time had a relevance to the particular moment in time that they were operating. But if you made the same commentary today, it wouldn't be a commentary. That's why, for example, I have a running argument with Leon Krier, one of the most intelligent men I know in architecture, who's teaching here this semester. And we have a running battle because he believes that there was a moment in time that was better than all other moments, and that there was a moment that was more truthful, more in touch with the deepest conditions of society. That is a hierarchical view of the world. I don't believe that there is such a moment in time that is more truthful than any other moment. And the kind of invocation that he makes, in other words, of a classical architecture today, suggests that there is some value to the classical that's more valuable than any other style of architecture. That would only be true if those symbols had value today. But in fact, if you build a classical courthouse today, while it had energy in the beginning of the United States in the early 19th century, because it related to the neoclassical moment of the French Revolution and therefore was seen to be revolutionary and independent and talking about a new society, if you build a classical courthouse today, it would be seen as looking backward to symbols that no longer evoked what they evoked, let's say, in the early 19th century. The second thing that I think about criticality is, number one, it speaks not only to its time, but to architecture. It makes a comment not only externally to conditions about it, but internally to architecture. Now, 99% of architecture is not critical. and 99% of you probably will not be involved in dealing with critical architecture. But I want you to know about it, what it means to be critical, because I believe that you should then have the choice. And if you don't know about it, it's hard to make a choice. I also believe that you are at Yale, as I said last week. You're at the top of the line. You struggle to get here mightily, supposedly. And there's no sense in sort of stepping back from the top. One always reaches for the ring. So what this class is about is not only looking, thinking, and drawing, but looking, thinking, and drawing critically. And not just drawing a plan or a section or an elevation or an axonometric, but drawing those conditions in the particular object that you're drawing that acted at the time critically. And therefore, you have to be able to look and learn to look and think, what was it that X did that changed things for Y? Now, you will realize, because you have Kurt Foster here tomorrow morning, you will realize that the kinds of discussions we have are similar but different, but also that the body of history is only made up of those architects and those buildings who challenged their moment in time. There were hundreds, probably, of architects working in the 15th century, in the 16th century, but we don't remember many of them because they don't constitute a history. History is constituted by those moments that challenge the conditions as they were. And I think that's why, universally, you may not like Brunelleschi's architecture, you may not like Alberti, there can be disagreements about why and where we study him, but in most cases, there is a general agreement that Alberti, Brunelleschi, Bramante are important architects, that is, of the first category. Why? Because their architecture embodied ideas of critical content. And what you're going to learn is how not just to see. You can go to the Piazza San Marco and take a picture. But can you take a critical picture? Can you find something in that lens, i.e. your eye or the camera, that marks Piazza San Marco as critical? Now, most people can't do that. Most people go to Piazza San Marco because, in fact, it is like a Coca-Cola. It's easy, it's known. You take a picture of Piazza San Marco and you can say you're in Venice, and you don't have to do any work. Your eyes don't do any work, your mind doesn't do any work, your body doesn't do any work. When I go to Venice, I avoid Piazza San Marco like the plague, because all the people that I don't want to deal with are there. I go to San Giorgio Maggiore, Redentore, by Palladio. Why? Because no tourists go. Why don't they go? Because it's difficult to look at. Architecture, I have a sign in my office, architecture is difficult, I am not. All right? And the earlier you learn that architecture is difficult, the quicker you'll get out. Because it's too difficult for the little money that you make. Okay, so we're going to look at things, and I'm going to try and explain what it is that we're doing as we go along, so that hopefully will be very clear. That all the terminology that I will use, I try to explain. If you don't get it, raise your hand. Now, part one. We're going to do two lectures today, and next week we're going to do some drawing for the third hour, and you are going to be drawing, looking at Brunelleschi's San Lorenzo and Santo Spirito. Now, again, if you go to Florence, very few people look at those two buildings. One, because they're across the river, and two, because everybody knows about the Duomo. They take pictures of the Duomo, they take pictures of the sculpture of David, and they have a Coca-Cola and go home. We're going to look at two churches that don't even have, in a sense, exteriors. They only have interiors. And you're going to begin to draw, for the first time, what are the critical elements that differentiate San Lorenzo from Santo Spirito, and or San Lorenzo and Santo Spirito from what went before. Now, that's tough. And you will get to understand what that is. So you're not going to draw a pretty picture of the church. There are plenty of pretty pictures of the church. You're not going to copy anything. Nobody has a drawing like this. Okay? So you're not going to find one in the books, in the reading, in any, you can't Google for it, etc. I learned how to do this, what I'm teaching, back in the summer of 1961. I traveled with a man named Colin Rowe, who was one of the most important historical theoreticians of the latter half of the 20th century. And Rowe took me 90 days and 90 nights to see architecture that was critical. I didn't know it at the time, and it was all very well selected and prepared. And we went to see Palladian villas, let's say, when there were no maps or guidebooks. We found the Palladian villas. And I used to look at this stuff, and I'd say, Colin, what is this stuff? It's terrible, right? You know, why are we looking at this? He said, sit there and look at it. And, of course, they were all three-story buildings. They all had a symmetry about them. And he said, you sit there in the sun until you can tell me something that is there that you cannot see. And that's what I mean by learning how to see. You've got to look at something and see an idea. Okay? Not the thing itself, but the idea of the thing. What makes what you see critical? The placement of the windows, the size of the windows relative to the size of the wall, the placement of the columns, the placement of the portico, whether it's in front, back, or in the wall. There are many, many issues in seeing. There's no one right way to see or one wrong way to see critically, but it is a way of using your imagination. So you're going to look at, like I did, at these buildings, right? And then you're going to draw the things that are not there to be seen literally. In other words, you're going to draw an idea. Now, I would like to think that this gentleman's question over here, that a meta-empiricism is taking from an empirical data some meta-critical idea. So that is some idea that goes beyond the thing itself, but, in other words, is not merely critical in and of itself in the building, but relates critically to architecture. And so we're going to be looking for not only critical conditions in Brunelleschi's two churches, but metacritical conditions. And therefore, metacritical means something that applies to architecture itself, not merely to the building, that transcends that is no longer just merely immanent to the empirical facts, but is immanent in architecture itself. And I believe that's what Mr. Zuliani means by meta-empirical. Okay. Now, we begin our story in the 14th century in northern Italy. We begin there because there was a shift, first of all in painting, and second of all in architecture. Now, up until that moment, there were no architects. There were master masons, but no one was called an architect. No one studied architecture, and there was no consciousness of architecture, because architecture was seen to be a transcendental condition. That is, it was ordinated by God. And in the theocentric, what I call epistem, the condition of thought in the 14th century, was a theocentric cosmology. That is, God mediated between man, the subject, and buildings, nature, the objects. And that triadic condition was about to change. But painters did have a role in that mediation. They presented what was in the Bible, written in visual representations, in buildings, in manuscripts, etc. They made the liturgy, which was in Latin, able to be understood by a great mass of people. So painting was a discipline, and it had a history. And this is going to be interesting for us when we get to Alberti next week. All architects were originally, or most architects were originally, apprenticed either to woodworkers, cabinet workers, masons, etc., or to painters. And many of the architects got their ideas about this movement from looking at painting and working with painters. Because painters who were interested in the fervor that existed in the late 14th century in northern Italy were beginning to paint in a different way. Meta-empirical, if you want. Meta-critical, if you want. That is, taking what they saw and transforming it through the discipline of painting itself. The moment in the late 14th century that we're going to see in the shift in the pictures that we look at was a movement, and a movement from what I would call a transcendental metaphysics. And of course, metaphysics and meta-empirical have a common ground, that is, beyond the physical, from a transcendental metaphysic to an immanent metaphysic. That is, a metaphysic that existed within things themselves. And so what happens first is that there is, in painting and in sculpture, before architecture, a beginning of a consciousness about the fact that not only was painting to be transcendental, that is, to relate the here and now to some greater being, but in fact had its own discourse within itself. That was something that made it disciplinary, a consciousness of painting. Before that, painting had no consciousness. It merely mediated between the viewing subject and God, presenting narratives about that relationship, but nothing to do with painting. So what happens is that there is a change, and that shift from what I call a transcendental metaphysic to an immanent metaphysic is what we are dealing with today. In other words, it's the immanent metaphysic is still in place. And if any of you have any knowledge of current philosophic thought, one of the great battles that is being fought is over the condition of metaphysics. Can we move metaphysics aside? Can we destabilize the idea of an immanent metaphysic? Now, why that is such a big problem in architecture is because architecture is thought to be the locus of the metaphysics of presence. In other words, we have metaphysical ideas in literature, in music, in painting, in philosophy, etc. But architecture, those metaphysical ideas are presented, immanent metaphysic, within the physical condition itself. And therefore, if we have a consciousness about this room and it has a metaphysical presence, can we move that in some way to the side? Can we be critical of that immanent metaphysic? So what I am arguing in this class is part of the understanding of what is critical has to begin when there was a shift from a transcendental metaphysic to an immanent one. And that shift was critical in the 14th, 15th, 16th, 17th, and 18th century, began to be dislodged in the 18th century, began to be questioned. And we will see in the evolution of our looking and thinking and drawing how the critical idea in relationship to that metaphysic has changed, and how it might be possible to use architecture as an important discipline to critique the problematic of an immanent metaphysic. Now those, you said to yourself, what is he talking about, right? You'll see. I'm just giving you the background to what you're going to see. The second issue that will come up in the critical context is the subject. In the movement from a transcendent to an immanent metaphysic, there is a movement from a theocentric cosmology or episteme to an anthropocentric episteme cosmology, which means that it is no longer God-centered, but man-centered, man generically. And that anthropocentrism becomes very important because it defines a metaphysical condition that is a consciousness, a metaphysic, about the subject. And since we have the immanent metaphysics of presence in the object here, we now have a consciousness of the subject that is the immanent metaphysic of an anthropocentric cosmology. We now have the subject-object dialectic. And therefore, we are now thinking about architecture in a different way because we now have a conscious subject. So that is the second condition that needs to be problematized, criticized, etc. That is the metaphysical dialectic between subject and object. Now, if there is a dialectical relationship that resolves itself between subject and object to produce a consciousness in the subject of the object, then we must have some means of communication. That is, a sign system. And we must have therefore, a capacity to read these signs. And therefore, what we get in the late 14th, but more likely in the middle of the 15th century, is an architecture that is not only physical presence, but also contains a sign system. Not paintings and representations, but a system about the architecture. That column is no longer merely just holding up the building, it is telling us something about the relationship of the subject to the object. So three conditions radically alter in the 15th century, and that is the question of the object, its presence, the question of the subject, its consciousness, and the question of the sign as, in a sense, mediating between the subject and the object. We're going to, in this class, watch the evolution of those ideas. Why is it important? Because if you don't know how those ideas developed, you will begin to try and reinvent the wheel today. There's no reason to do that. So what the first thing you have to do, I believe, as a student here, as a student anywhere, is to learn what it is that your discipline is, that is, what is architecture? How did it get to be this way? What can it do and not do, and where could it go? So I'm going to try and show you how we got to where we are, and then cut you loose, because then it's up to you. What I'm assuming is, with this particular kind of way of seeing, way of thinking, and knowledge, at least you will know when you're doing poopy. Okay? You may not be able to do good, but you'll be able to know what poopy is. Alright? And there's a lot of it all around. Right? And that's the interesting thing. Now, I would imagine that you don't have any questions, because you probably say, well, I'll believe that. Let me look and see what he's talking about. But in case you do have any questions, and this is free time for asking dumb questions, by the way, because if there's any place to ask dumb questions, it's here. And if you have some dumb ones, go ahead.
I have a dumb one. Do you believe in the idea of progression, that we need to get somewhere that is better than now?
No. I'm not teaching progress. What I'm suggesting when I say that we have to make a critical commentary on the now doesn't mean we're going to make it any better. It makes it that we are going to become more conscious of the now. Why we live and go to school and study and read and think, etc., is to become more conscious of our existence in order to live it more fully. and I believe that architecture helps one to live more fully, and the way to do that is to develop a better consciousness. In other words, you go and study music to train your ear to be more conscious of why Bach, Beethoven, etc. are good, right? You just don't go and hear the tunes, all right? Here we're developing not our ears, but our eyes to understand why Palladio, Brunelleschi, names you will hear, are important to your consciousness, that you can bring them to bear on what you do today. I'm not suggesting, since I've been teaching for 40 years, I have never thought of progress, right? Because I'm not interested in progress. I'm interested in your consciousness being expanded so that you can have a fuller life. And i.e., if you build something for somebody, those people can have a fuller, teeny bit fuller, not better, a more richer, expansive condition of now. Where architecture has always gone wrong is it believed itself to be a socially progressive condition, that is, to make the world better. We now, in other words, when I was in school in 1950, sitting in a class like this, I got up every morning thinking that I could save the world. The Howard Roark syndrome, if you've never read The Fountainhead is an example of that. Roark thought he could make the world better. Not that I'm disillusioned, because I'm still here. Well, of course, I don't have anything else necessarily to do, you could argue. You know, might as well do something. Well, I could be playing golf, but I'm interested in expanding consciousness. I think architecture does that. The only way to do that is to be conscious of what is, to have an idea about what one is doing. So therefore, I'm not talking about any progressive view. Okay? Does that help?
Yeah.
Yes. Not remove, whether we can displace. In other words, is it possible to have another dominant philosophic condition other than the metaphysics? All right. Now, certainly, all of, and I'm not a philosophy major. All right. Certainly, all of post-structuralism, French post-structuralist thought, centers on this issue of metaphysics. And second to that, I would argue that a second issue that is dominant, at least in painting, sculpture, architecture, is the question of opticality. That part of the metaphysics of presence is the fact that the subject learned the relationship between architecture and the human through the eyes. The eyes have been the dominant mode of understanding. And so what the displacement is also about is, can we displace opticality as a dominant mode of experience? All right? Now, I don't know if you're a philosophy major or whatever. Do you understand what I've just said?
Yeah, I was a painting major.
Yeah. Well, you know about the question of opticality and what the minimalists were trying to do, and the post-minimalists, and the color field people, and etc. I mean, there's a whole history of painting that deals with the question of opticality. The magazine October, I don't know if you know the magazine October, but if you don't, you should have, as a painting major, you should have damn well have known it. I mean, maybe you were painting still lifes and things, but I mean, you know, the questioning of collage. Is collage any longer a relevant means of dealing with painting? I don't think it is. There's a reason why it isn't. Montage in film, in photography. So there are a lot of issues that deal with the optical that we're going to look at. I don't know if that answers your question, but...
Well, I was just wondering if you were, like, aware of really contemporary painting right now, which I feel is kind of like... I mean, I don't know if you've heard about, like, kind of, like, the resurgence of painting and drawing as opposed to, like, conceptual and installation. I don't know if it really happened in the 80s and 90s. And some of the Fort Thunder stuff that's going on right now, Forest Field stuff, is kind of all about, like, a, I think some people haven't been able to, like, categorize it, but people are talking about kind of like a reduced sensuality as opposed to, like, physical painting. And it kind of, like, attempt to, like, purge that meta awareness that you were talking about. It was so prevalent in the 70s.
Well, I'm not... criticality is an attempt to purge and meta awareness to deal with it in the object. I believe that sensuality of the object can be critical. For example, if sensuality is in painting, let's say, or sculpture, as long as it doesn't resituate opticality, I'm interested in it. The minute it makes opticality thematic, I don't think it's either sensuous or denying metacriticality, let's say. But we're not here to debate painting. I'm not very much interested in contemporary painting. I could tell you that as a prejudice, but I'm allowed to have prejudices. I mean, I don't think... I'm more interested in contemporary sculpture. I'm more interested in those people who deal with space and time in a non, say, optical, retinal way. I mean, for example, Jasper Johns said in the 1950s when giving a eulogy to Duchamp, what Duchamp did for painting was to free painting from opticality. We still have not come to terms with Duchamp, I think. My opinion. Okay? We can disagree, but fortunately, we don't have to worry about that. Okay? I'm trying to get you into architecture, and we don't have to deal with Johns or Duchamp.
Right. Okay. So I feel like there's certain trends moving in the art world that have always presaged architecture to a certain small degree, like you were saying in the 14th century.
Yeah, well, there may be. I'm very interested in sensuality as criticality. So, we'll see. Any other, there was another question, yeah. No, you already had a question. Let me get somebody else. You have, yes?
Just sort of, I'm trying to get the sense of the timeline. What was sort of the dominant period before this? You talked about socially progressive thinking of architecture as being socially progressive in the 60s, and then did that sort of lead into what we're talking about now as
architectural theory, or
I don't know what comes before this, what we're talking about right now. Does that make sense?
What comes before post-structuralism?
Oh, what comes before post-structuralism in philosophy? Structuralism. Where all of this comes from is, let's say, in 1945, post-World War II. There's a great consciousness that modernism failed, that the utopia promised, progressive, social, left utopia of modern thought, philosophy, painting, music, architecture, dead. Okay? And so what do we do? The beginnings of what happened began with French existentialism, let's say, all you have to do is read Sartre, Camus, Gide, and these guys, all right? And you begin to see about the hopelessness. You just accept things as they are, right? You don't try and make them better. You don't try and make them worse. You just are, right? In Gide's Lafcadio's Adventures, there's a wonderful moment where a guy is sitting on a train looking across at another guy is so unable to be motivated by anything, he says, huh, I wonder if I can commit the perfect crime, right? If 10 lights go by before 3 minutes outside, I'll throw this guy off the train, right? I mean, just random, arbitrary thinking, right? And so 10 lights go by, throws the guy off the train, and it turns out, after the investigation, you know, he thinks he's committed the perfect crime, that he's the only person that was sitting there that could have killed this guy for various reasons. So that's a form of existentialism. I mean, the Camus, the stranger, about the guy who kills a guy accidentally on a beach and then says, I can't do anything about it, and the priest says, confess, and we'll get you off. And he said, well, I don't believe in confession, right? And it's that sort of thing, so he doesn't confess, and they hang him, right? And he'd rather be hanged than confess something that he doesn't believe in. This is sort of world without any hope, any values, etc. Presaged, obviously, by Robert Musil's Man Without Qualities, great triadic novel. Presaged by Nietzsche's nihilism, etc. And then people began to think about hope and structures. In other words, if we understand structures, maybe we'll be able to put the world back together again. And so you have people like Levi-Strauss going off and studying African tribes to understand how native structures operate, etc. And you have people like Roland Barthes writing a book called Writing Degree Zero, which is going back to the beginning of thinking and writing and being. And then the post-structuralists who are saying this is back to bringing metaphysics into being, and in other words, a belief in structures is again a problematic. Why should we believe in structure any more than no structure? In other words, why should we believe as opposed to not believe? And the whole notion of negative thinking, Walter Benjamin, Theodore Adorno, etc., were prominent, let's say. And then you have the post-structuralists like Gilles Deleuze, Jacques Derrida, Jacques Lacan, Emmanuel Levinas, who is a metaphysician, actually. But, I mean, that's as far as I can get you. If you said to me, what's happening in philosophy today, right? I mean, like this guy says, well, this is what's happening in painting. I'm a dumb architect, all right? I don't know what's happening in philosophy today or what's happening in painting. I read Art Forum, and I have my thoughts about it, and I talk to people like Richard Serra and Michael Heiser, and I know what they think about contemporary painting, and I talk to certain philosophers, and I know what they think about current philosophy, but I'm not trying to let you know where we are. You're going to figure that out. I don't need to know where we are, because I ain't going to be there. I'm going to try and get you to where we are, rather than, and I got to do that fairly quickly. You know, I'm collapsing 5 centuries into, you know, 12 lectures. Any other questions? Yeah.
Can you just flesh out the idea a little bit more with the new term to me of imminent metaphysics? Because in my mind right now, I'm sort of relating it to postmodernism, objects or ideas, symbols of other objects or ideas that have sort of their own independent meaning, separate from whatever world they exist.
But they have an imminent metaphysic. I mean, the fact that they have a meaning internal to those objects without relating to any is no longer a transcendent but an imminent metaphysic. That's what I'm saying exists today. We are in the world of the objects of an imminent metaphysic. Okay, that, yes, postmodernism is a very good example of that. We're not going to, we got to be careful not to overthink it. because we've got to be able to look. And I'm going to try and teach you, I'm not teaching you how to think, because you can all have your feelings about, you know, what makes a good film, what makes a good painting, what makes a good building, etc. I'm going to teach you, I think, or open your eyes to how to look differently. And therefore, that's the most important thing I can do. Have you look differently at what you see, and then be able to translate those things into ideas, and then to be able to draw them. And there is a very different thing than saying, draw this. Right? All of you eventually could draw this. Right? And if I say draw it in 1 minute, you could probably do that. And if I said draw it in 10 seconds, you could probably learn to do that. But to draw it in 10 seconds, you got to begin to have an idea about this. What constitutes this? You wouldn't start making the letters on the bottle, and you wouldn't start, you know, coloring it blue, the label, etc. If I said do it in 10 seconds, you'd have to have an idea about this. Now, what you're doing essentially is having an idea about things in the history of architecture that have ideas within them, and that you have to take as given, because you can say, well, why are we looking at San Lorenzo and Santo Spirito as opposed to the Duomo? Well, because they have certain lessons inherent in them that you will discover. And it's less likely that you will discover them by drawing the Duomo. There are certain things that have more critical content than other things. Now, this gentleman brought up the new sensuality or the new sense of beauty. I cannot teach you beauty. I mean, when we look at San Lorenzo and Santo Spirito, I cannot say they're beautiful, right? And then you would say, well, why are they beautiful? And I wouldn't necessarily be able to tell you why they're beautiful, because I don't care if they're beautiful or not, because beauty is not an absolute condition. That has been debated throughout history, whether Greek beauty or Roman beauty is more important, between Winckelmann and Lessing, there is no, in these terms, absolute conditions. And so therefore, we are not looking to see beauty. In other words, I'm not looking. In other words, when I go down to an art show in Greenwich Village on Sundays, an amateur art show, there's no painting, right, there. In other words, nobody has an idea about painting. They paint vases, they have pretty colors, etc., but there ain't any ideas. I don't want to put dumb vase on my wall, right? I'm only interested in putting on my wall things that cause me to see beyond what's on the wall. And because otherwise my wall would be cluttered with junk. You know, how else would I determine that? And to me, the judge of painting is something that presents in whatever form painting, as opposed to a pot with flowers, etc. And the same thing goes with architecture. What architecture for me is something that goes beyond a bedroom, a bathroom, a kitchen, etc. Or having nice fixtures. Oh, I've got this brand new stove, right? Great. There are no critical ideas in stoves. Or I've got this new refrigerator that holds 48 beers at one time, right? That's not an idea. I don't give a damn about what kind of refrigerator or what kind of stove you have. I'm interested, does your kitchen have any ideas? And you could say, well, why do we need ideas in our kitchen? Maybe you don't. And that's probably why I don't do houses anymore, because I'm not convinced that you have to have ideas in your kitchen. I can't live in dumbness. That's my particular predilection. I'm not telling you all that what I think and do and how I am is correct. I'm merely going to show you from a certain point of view how it is possible to see beyond the thing itself, to see beyond the facts of being, and into another world. Now, for example, when we read Shakespeare, we know the story. I don't read Hamlet to find out what's going to happen at the end, like a mystery novel. I know what's going to happen. So why do we read Hamlet? We read Hamlet for the joy of reading, of hearing the sounds, either in our head or out loud. We read Hamlet for the constructions, for the double meanings and triple meanings and ideas loaded in the words that have nothing to do with the story, that might have a meta literary value. When a composer wants to understand a piece of music, he or she doesn't hear it performed. They look at the score. They're interested in reading the score and hearing the music for themselves. They don't want an interpretation. You all are training to be composers of architecture. So you have to learn how to read scores. So therefore, it ain't important to go out and look at buildings and photograph buildings and see how they're played by others. It's important to read the score. That's a particular point of view. It's not right or wrong, but unfortunately, you in this class, and you've got to take this class, and I'm here. So whether this gentleman over there, the expert on painting, says, you know, you're not up to date on the new painting, I'm sorry. No, I'm cartooning. I'm being ironic.
I think you're aware of this comment. I know you discussed post-9/11, kind of like
yeah.
Post-irony,
yeah.
Kind of like you didn't consciousness about, and kind of I think a failure for theory that we've been discussing before in the last half century, like a failure to connect.
Well, look, here's the thing. I'm not talking about the last half century. I'm now in the 15th century, right? And I'm going to try and get you up to date. You may have what I think is a problem is anybody that comes with a fixed set of ideas. What I need you to do is leave what you thought about things at the door. All right? Because if you're going to see, you can't say, I know how to see already. You got to look in a different way. And I would imagine that most of you, especially this gentleman who's never looked at architecture, but we'll see next week with your drawings. I'll be very interested to see your drawings. Okay? I'm going to look hard. All right? I got you marked. So, we'll see. I always appreciate the challenge. All right? I mean, I love playing. I mean, I lost a bet to this guy last week. But, you know, we'll have a chance to make it up. You still got to play Ohio State.
Yeah, I know. We'll yeah. Let it ride.
What?
We'll let it ride.
No, I want to pay you. But I want to make sure I get another bet with the same spread, you know? I mean, whatever it is in the day of the game. Okay, before we look at the picks, we'll take a 10-minute break. Let's go. Be back, please, in 10 minutes. Transcripts of these lectures, oral transcripts, will be posted when?
As soon as the class server
Okay? So you can re-listen, and then in a week's time, it will be posted to your email a written, written transcript of what I've said with the list of illustrations and the illustrations. So there is no reason to be taking notes. All right? It's just a waste of time, and you can't look at the screen and take notes, right? And you can't listen to me while you're taking notes, you know. So, the only reason why we do, I could just, you know, do this on TV and stay in New York. So the whole idea of being in this terrible room with me is really important, okay? And to catch the feeling of it, you know, the sensuality of being here together. Okay? Everybody clear? I'm waiting for them next week. We're going to have fun. Any questions about where we are or where we haven't been? No. Okay. You shouldn't be afraid just because I've intimidated him. Get to the rest of you, you know. I mean, my favorite people are the ornery people, okay? If you sit and just sort of smile for 12 weeks, you don't get anywhere, right? If you make yourself obnoxious, it's really good. I have a whole office full of obnoxious people.
Well,
one of my students just invited me to a party on Sunday and said, the one thing that all of your students have loved about you is that you're really stinky. And I wrote back and I said, I'm not stinky, I'm just ornery. And I learned it from my students. What about the monkey?
You want to tell them the story of the monkey?
What about the story of the monkey? Why don't you tell them? This guy?
Why do you have a monkey?
This guy? This, each year, this is basically a Yale guy. All right, you have to understand that. 3 years, two years ago, this is the third year, I had a wonderful big floppy dog. You remember that dog?
I remember hearing the story.
Yeah, the dog. What?
We weren't here when you had a dog.
Okay, I had a dog. I forget what we called the dog. And I would bring him to all the reviews in my class. And one of the classes stole my dog.
like a real dog? Or
No, a stuffed dog.
Oh.
I had a dog. I don't know the difference between a real dog and a stuffed dog. I like stuffed dogs better because you don't have to walk them. So he stole my dog. I was really upset. I told my class that you shouldn't let that happen. So last year, I brought this guy. All right, and I told my students they had to protect this guy. It was a matter of honor that they protect my gorilla, right? And they did, although there were many attempts to steal the gorilla. And so I brought him back. I kept him warm all year, and I'm going to give him to my class today. And I guess what Tate is referring to is I refer to people as monkeys, all right? I just do. It's a term of endearment, you know? And I'm fascinated by monkeys. I also refer to myself as a gorilla. And what's important about my being here is that I'm not just a teacher, but I'm an architectural gorilla, all right? And I think it's important, if you all aspire to being a gorilla, whether male or female, to learn about the care and feeding of gorillas, all right? And you can only do that by being with them. And I always believe that gorillas should teach because they set role model examples. We don't have enough female gorillas in architecture, and there's a reason for that, and that is that when I went to school, the Ivy League didn't admit women, and there were no women in our classes. So the people who have grown up to be gorillas are, by and large, men. Zaha Hadid is a female gorilla. If you want to learn about what's like to be with a female gorilla, I think is Zaha coming this spring?
Yeah.
You would take her studio. Female gorillas are just as problematic as male gorillas. So, you know, the question of gender to me is immaterial, because what I've noticed is that everybody wants to be a gorilla, whether they're men or women, and whether they're men or women, they behave just as badly when they become gorillas as the other gender. So for me, the idea of a gorilla is genderless, all right? I'm absolutely convinced that in this class, 20 years from now, there'll be more female gorillas than male gorillas, okay? No question, there will be more. Because everybody asks me, well, how come there are not any more female gorillas, right? Well, they just weren't around in training 20 years ago. If a woman went to a university like Yale, something like Vassar, for example, which is where the women who eventually came to Yale went, their idea of the world was to get married and to raise kids. My first wife was a woman like that, and the thought of working was unacceptable. I'm amazed that I've lived through that period. I cannot think that a woman wouldn't think of getting a job today. But in those days, women were still Victorian, and very few of them went into professions. I didn't say they were all, but and they also were kept in all women's colleges, so whatever the case. In any case, this is my Yale gorilla, and it represents several things to me that are important. One, a gorilla. Two, football. So I bring him here. Is that good enough, Tate? Did you guys win the other week? No.
We lost by 1 point.
Yeah, to a dumb team. Somebody's here from that place, right? Clemson, yeah. So you guys can't be very good. But and you'll be happy to know that Texas is going to lose this weekend. So you know that. So they're going to get killed. Come on.
I wouldn't mind seeing Ohio State lose.
No, you wouldn't. You want to see Ohio State? What?
I'll take a bet on that.
Oh, hey! There we go. The spread is, I think, 2 points. you get 2 points.
Okay.
All right?
Okay.
What are we betting?
You name it.
No. We have to be really careful. This is, you know. we have to be very careful because I could be accused of harassing you if I take money from you, you know?
I understand.
So what can we bet? I bet money with him, but he's my TA. I mean, you want to bet money? Or you want to bet something else? You want to bet a book?
A book.
How about a book? I give out books at the end of the year. How about a book?
Book.
You're on. 2 points and a book.
2 points and a book. What's
your
name?
Bo. That's Bo. Beaumont.
He's down.
He's down for two. Anybody else for two? Going once? Okay. I'm glad to hear that we have some, you know, horns around.
Well, I'm from A&M, so go figure. But
he's from A&M?
Yeah.
So what's he betting on? That's right. Well, okay. Do we want to extinguish the lights? No, I need to look at... Can you guys see the slides? Yeah, I think it is. No, it isn't. I got it. Thanks. Yeah. It's on. Yeah, good. We're talking now about medieval tapestries, probably late 13th, early 14th century. And what I think is important is that these conditions are what I call illustrations. In other words, they are not the actual figures themselves, but they stand for the figures. And that's what is very important about the change. In other words, they're not, they illustrate archetypal figures. And the scenes they illustrate are archetypical. Now here we have supposedly, I assume, Moses crossing the Dead Sea, and here are people, you know, walking on water. And clearly this is about as good as they could do for water, this kind of spaghetti, but you recognize it as not earth. And you recognize that the people are supposedly in the water. They're obviously not swimming, but walking. You have, as it were, a flattening of, there's no perspective. In other words, everything is flat. Here is a boat and another boat in the same water, but they're clearly not in perspective at all. And what you get is what I would call a spatialization of time. There is time depicted. In other words, here these guys have sailed from here, these guys have landed. And so you see three distinct moments. These guys are building a fire over here, there's a fortress over here, a woods, a beach, but these events are a narrative of people landing from a boat, coming ashore, building a fire, etc. But they're seen in, they're identified in space rather than in time. So they are what I call a spatialization of time. Now, they are paintings, as it were, which have no knowledge of depth. There is no idea of a picture plane. So they're still not what I would call an immanent metaphysic in the picture. There's no consciousness that there is a subject who needs a plane of reference to see depth. So there is no idea of picture plane. And of course, picture plane, stress on the canvas, on the edge and the center, etc., compositional codes, which are part of an immanent metaphysic, don't exist yet. Next two. This is another figure in a pool of water, this is a picture of a castle near water. And of course, water is one of the themes that clearly is part of the condition of being, the relationship of earth, water, sky. There's a figure supposedly walking in the water. And here, what's interesting, this is clearly two dormer windows and a recession, but they didn't know how to paint this recession into the actual roof. So you see these angled lines to suggest some sort of depth that is a difference between this plane back here, and the plane in the front, which is all seen as flat. So again, these are all very stylized paintings. Next, please. Now, here are two examples of Last Supper. You have to notice the stylization. Here is the table and the people sitting around the table. This is the meal, the fatted calf. But notice what's interesting about these two examples is that here the people are outboard in niches, flat. And here they're painted inboard of the table. So they are sitting inboard, as it were, of the condition. That here is the table. And so one, they're turned in, one, they are turned out. And if you were to set these guys, stand them up, they were, in fact, be looking outward rather than inward. These guys would be looking inward at the table. So one could argue that these figures are iconic in that is they have a similitude to the apostles at the Last Supper. They're also symbolic in the sense that they have an agreed upon convention. We know this to be a Last Supper. And we're going to talk about, as we continue to talk about these things, the idea of the sign, the three conventions of the sign as icon, symbol, and index set forward by the American philosopher and pragmatist Charles Sanders Peirce. These are, in a sense, more symbolic in the sense that they are conventional than they are iconic. We are moving from the symbolic toward the iconic, that is, toward the literal representation of the figures. In other words, they're still illustrative, archetypal figures. We know them to be apostles by the halos around their heads. All of those things are agreed upon symbolic conventions of the time, but they don't necessarily look like the people that they are supposed to be. Next, please. Now, these are figures of on the church facade at Pisa by the brothers, the Pisani brothers. And what is interesting is this is just like the paintings you saw. There's no sense of perspective. There's depth. There is three-dimensionality. But there's no sense of composition. I mean, there is no condition that where is the ground, where is the sky, where is the center, where is the edge, where is the picture plane. These are, again, in another sense, a spatialization of time. In other words, different events are happening which are across the canvas, as it were, across the facade, and people would look at these and learn the lessons that they were about. So what we're seeing here in one compressed area is, in fact, a series of events that take place in time. So there is no hierarchy, there is no center, there is no perspective. Can I have the next one, please? We begin to see in here, again by the Pisanis, and again on Pisa Cathedral, a differentiation of center and edge. There is clearly a centric composition here, and the peripheral figures, but we can see that there are the scene of the body coming off the cross, and then here is, in a sense, a different moment in time, again, made through spatial organization. But there's no question that this sequence of figures here has to do with a centric composition. And we begin, and we still have no dominant, immanent metaphysic that is a relationship of a figure to ground. Next, please. And here we have some what I would call transitional portal figures. They are carved into the door jambs next to the door. So you can see here are the wooden doors of the Pisa Cathedral. And here are these elongated figures that become column-like. And we're beginning to see a background, just beginning to see a condition of the figure distinguished from the frame. We begin to see a frame now, articulated frame, and we begin to see a proto-baldacchino here as a beginning to distinguish the figure from the architecture and also from the field. Next, please. And here we begin to see, again, still illustrated figures, still not necessarily iconic, having a similitude. We have the 12 apostles and four apostles over here. And we begin to see little baldacchini. In other words, we have the halos, and then we have these architectural elements that will gradually become more and more developed, more and more tectonic, as it were, and more, as it were, frames for the figures. And as we see here, these figures are still very symbolic. They're conventional. There's no perspective. They are probably meant to be seen in depth. And even in sculpture, we see them as very flat and having very little to do with the architectural embellishment around. Next, please. And here we see on this four virgins over here and three wise men sleeping. On the left, we see fully developed baldacchini. In other words, the baldacchini now have come out and become not only the base for these figures, but the surround. So we now have the ground, as it were, becoming figure. And we now have a fully figured ground. And of course, this, as opposed to this piece over here, is the beginning of what one would call the metaphysical dialectic between figure and ground, which is still a convention, certainly in architecture, if not in painting. A discourse that, in other words, there is a ground, it is a datum, we walk on that ground, there are those issues which come into being. Now, they come into being as a critique of a non-figure ground relationship, a non-articulated dialectic, as we see over here, non-perspectival, and they become the critical vehicle for the Renaissance. And that's what I'm saying, is that that critical vehicle for the Renaissance has been through various stylistic iterations in place for 400 years. Now notice, by the way, that these figures, as opposed to these guys over here, are beginning to be gestural and three-dimensional and enclose space in themselves. Look at the gesture of the arms here, here, here. They're all doing something very specific and starting to take on specific characteristics. So very important to see the transition from the late 14th century to the 15th and then early 16th century. And these are very famous, these four virgins are very famous works, and you can see how the architectural being, even though it's still very medieval in its being, if you look at the pointed arches and the idea of the architecture, and in these embellishments here, you begin to see a three-dimensionality which is no longer flat, which is no longer merely symbolic, but starts to become iconic. Can I have the next one, please? And here we have a knight on a horse, and again a baldacchino, which sort of sits without any architectural reasoning behind, merely to frame this figure of the knight and give it a centrality in the architecture. And on the right, we have Bonaventure's St. Francis. And of course, these are scenes from the life of St. Francis. They're painted flat. And again, what I would call the spatialization of time. But here, there is, number one, a centralized composition, and the frame relates to the figure. The figure is located in the center, seems to be pushing the frame up, as it were, distinguishing between the head and the foot. Certainly an elongated figure to be able to get all of these scenes in. So there's an enormous difference. We're beginning this. Still, the figure is very flat. The modeling of the robes are very flat. The way this line here comes down, and the way you look at the feet in relationship to the robes, and the flatness of the architectural condition on the side. Notice we have these Romanesque arches, very much in the medieval and the kind of turrets and castles, what they were doing, but there's still no perspective, no depth, and no time in depth. In other words, we have these little vignettes now framed in the painting, the structure of the painting. So when we look, what is critical about both of these, this and this, even though they're different stylistically, they tell different things, it's not a question of them being good painting. It's the idea of the centralization of the composition, certainly the relationship of the central figure to the central axis of this bay, reinforced by this baldacchino, and the sort of centralization, elongation of the figure becoming the axis both here and here, and the panelization of the scenery. In other words, now we have the time is no longer in space, but in panels. That we now are reread it like we do an illustrated book or a comic book. We now see them in panels that are clearly defined. So this is a critique of the spatialization of time that occurred in medieval painting, and we begin to see now time represented by a series of frames. And so the frame becomes very important. Again, it's not a question of good or bad, it's a question of understanding how to look at the work. Okay, next one, please. These are two paintings by Duccio at the Pisa Cathedral. Again, this is a board. This is paint on a board. And notice, again, the sequence now of frames, both vertically and horizontally, and even a minor separation, so that the idea of the frame, even though they're flat and not very either perspectivally correct, we're beginning to get a idea that the frame is important in relationship to what is being seen. And over here now we suddenly have for the first time the architecture in the painting framing figures, that is, figures outside and inside, outside and inside. And details, these are details from here. And you're beginning to see, still have a Gothic arch here, sort of Gothic Moorish kind of arch here, but there's starting to be a perspectival depth awareness, so that the frame and the idea of perspective begins to come together, framing the scene, making sure that this figure is distinguished from this figure over here. And of course, now we see Christ becoming iconic. That is, there is a similitude. We now know that this is what Christ is supposed to look like. And what's interesting about this is you have to notice that this arch is off-center, this is off-center, and that Christ is now not so much in the center of the whole composition, but in the center of this architectural frame. Christ exists in the center of that frame. So the frame, we have a frame within a frame, because we have the literal frame of the literal canvas, which puts this man over here on the edge. And then we have Christ here in the center of an architectural frame. So there's a frame within a frame, and then more. So that there is this sequence of framing that is very important. Can we have the next one, please? This is, again, scenes from that board. This is the Last Supper over here, and the detail of two Christs here and here, and of course now there's a little bit of perspective. You can notice that there is perspectival as minor as it is, but you begin to see in Duccio, which is a transitional painter, a movement, so that there is a focal point. So we begin to see the architecture in perspective, framing as it